God. In waking, eating, working, dreaming, sleeping, serving, meditating, chanting, divinely loving, my soul constantly hums, unheard by any, God. God, God. Sometimes usually on the first of the month when the bills rolled in for upkeep of the Mount Washington and other self-realization fellowship centers exclamation mark I thought longingly of the simple peace of India. But daily I saw a widening understanding between West and East, my soul rejoiced. I have found the great heart of America expressed in the wondrous lines by Emma Lazarus, carved at the base of the Statue of Liberty, the mother of exiles, from her beacon hand. Glows worldwide welcome, her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp, cries she with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me, I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Chapter 38. Tentific knowledge is love. Luther Burbank uttered this wisdom as I walked beside him in his Santa Rosa garden. We halted near a bed of edible cacti. While I was conducting experiments to make spineless cacti, he continued, I often talked to the plants to create a vibration of love. You have nothing to fear, I would tell them. You don't need your defensive thorns. I will protect you. Gradually the useful plant of the desert emerged in a thornless variety. I was charmed at this miracle. Please, dear Luther, give me a few cacti leaves to plant in my garden at Mount Washington. A workman standing nearby started to strip off some leaves. Burbank prevented him. I myself will pluck them for the Swami. He handed me three leaves, which later I planted, rejoicing as they grew to huge estate. The great horticulturist told me that his first notable triumph was the large potato, now known by his name. With the indefatigability of genius, he went on to present the world with hundreds of crossed improvements on nature. His new Burbank varieties of tomato, corn, squash, cherries, plums, nectarines, berries, poppies, lilies, roses. I focused my camera as Luther led me before the famous walnut tree by which he had proved that natural evolution can be telescopically hastened. Luther Burbank, beloved friend, poses with me in his Santa Rosa garden. In only 16 years, he said, this walnut tree reached a state of abundant nut production to which an unaided nature would have brought the tree in twice that time. Burbank's little adopted daughter came romping with her dog into the garden. She is my human plant. Luther waved to her affectionately. I see humanity now as one vast plant, needing for its highest fulfillments only love, the natural blessings of the great outdoors, and intelligent crossing and selection. In the span of my own lifetime I have observed such wondrous progress in plant evolution that I look forward optimistically to a healthy, happy world as soon as its children are taught the principles of simple and rational living. We must return to nature and nature's God. Luther, you would delight in my ranch high school, with its outdoor classes, and atmosphere of joy and simplicity. My words touched the chord closest to Burbank's heart. Child education. He plied me with questions, interest gleaming from his deep, serene eyes. Swamiji, he said finally, schools like yours are the only hope of a future millennium. I am in revolt against the educational systems of our time, severed from nature and stifling of all individuality. I am with you heart and soul in your practical ideals of education. As I was taking leave of the gentle sage, he autographed a small volume and presented it to me. Here is my book on the training of the human plant, he said. New types of training are needed. Fearless experiments. At times the most daring trials have succeeded in bringing out the best in fruits and flowers. Educational innovations for children should likewise become more numerous, more courageous. I read his little book that night with intense interest. His eye envisioning a glorious future for the race, he wrote, the most stubborn living thing in this world, the most difficult to swerve, is a plant once fixed in certain habits. Remember that this plant has preserved its individuality all through the ages. Perhaps it is one which can be traced backward through eons of time in the very rocks themselves, never having varied to any great extent in all these vast periods. Do you suppose, after all these ages of repetition, the plant does not become possessed of a will, if you so choose to call it, of unparalleled tenacity? Indeed, there are plants, like certain of the palms, so persistent that no human power has yet been able to change them. The human will is a weak thing beside the will of a plant. But see how this whole plant's lifelong stubbornness is broken simply by blending a new life with it, making, by crossing, a complete and powerful change in its life. Then when the break comes, fix it by these generations of patient supervision and selection, and the new plant sets out upon its new way, never again to return to the old, its tenacious will broken and changed at last. When it comes to so sensitive and pliable a thing as the nature of a child, the problem becomes vastly easier. Magnetically drawn to this great American, I visited him again and again. One morning I arrived at the same time as the postman, who deposited in Burbank's study about 1,000 letters. Horticulturists wrote him from all parts of the world. "Swamiji, your presence is just the excuse I need to get out into the garden," Luther said gaily. He opened a large desk drawer containing hundreds of travel folders. "See," he said, "this is how I do my traveling. Tied down by my plants and correspondence, I satisfy my desire for foreign lands by a glance now and then at these pictures." My car was standing before his gate. Luther and I drove along the streets of the little town, its gardens bright with his own varieties of Santa Rosa, Beach Blow, and Burbank roses. "My friend Henry Ford and I both believe in the ancient theory of reincarnation," Luther told me. "It sheds light on aspects of life otherwise inexplicable. Memory is not a test of truth. Just because man fails to remember his past lives does not prove he never had them. Memory is blank concerning his womb life and infancy, too, but he probably passed through them." He chuckled. The great scientist had received cryo-initiation during one of my earlier visits. "I practice the technique devoutly, Swamiji," he said. After many thoughtful questions to me about various aspects of yoga, Luther remarked slowly, "The East indeed possesses immense hoards of knowledge which the West has scarcely begun to explore. Intimate communion with nature, who unlocked to him many of her jealously guarded secrets, had given Burbank a boundless spiritual reverence. Sometimes I feel very close to the infinite power," he confided shyly, his sensitive, beautifully modeled face lit with his memories. "Then I have been able to heal sick persons around me, as well as many ailing plants." He told me of his mother, a sincere Christian. "Many times after her death," Luther said, "I have been blessed by her appearance in visions. She has spoken to me." We drove back reluctantly toward his home and those waiting 1,000 letters. "Luther," I remarked, "next month I am starting a magazine to present the truth offerings of East and West. Please help me decide on a good name for the journal." We discussed titles for a while, and finally agreed on East-West. After we had re-entered his study, Burbank gave me an article he had written on science and civilization. "This will go in the first issue of East-West," I said gratefully. As our friendship grew deeper, I called Burbank my American saint. "Behold a man," I quoted, "in whom there is no guile." His heart was fathomlessly deep, long acquainted with humility, patience, sacrifice. His little home amidst the roses was austerely simple. He knew the worthlessness of luxury, the joy of few possessions. The modesty with which he wore his scientific fame repeatedly reminded me of the trees that bend low with the burden of ripening fruits. "It is the barren tree that lifts its head high in an empty burst." I was in New York when, in 1926, my dear friend passed away. In tears I thought, "Oh, I would gladly walk all the way from here to Santa Rosa for one more glimpse of him." Locking myself away from secretaries and visitors, I spent the next 24 hours in seclusion. The following day I conducted a Vedic memorial rite around a large picture of Luther. A group of my American students, garbed in Hindu ceremonial clothes, chanted the ancient hymns as an offering was made of flowers, water, and fire, symbols of the bodily elements and their release in the infinite source. Though the form of Burbank lies in Santa Rosa under a Lebanon cedar that he planted years ago in his garden, his soul is enshrined for me in every wide-eyed flower that blooms by the wayside. Withdrawn for a time into the spacious spirit of nature, is that not Luther whispering in her winds, walking her dawns? His name has now passed into the heritage of common speech. Listing Burbank as a transitive verb, Webster's New International Dictionary defines it, to cross or graft, a plant. Hence, figuratively, to improve, anything, as a process or institution, by selecting good features and rejecting bad, or by adding good features. Beloved Burbank, I cried after reading the definition, your very name is now a synonym for goodness. Chapter 39, Threes Newman, the Catholic stigmatist, return to India. I have waited for you patiently for 15 years. Soon I shall swim out of the body and onto the shining abode. Yogananda, come. Sri Yukteswar's voice sounded startlingly in my inner ear as I sat in meditation at my Mount Washington headquarters. Traversing 10,000 miles in the twinkling of an eye, his message penetrated my being like a flash of lightning. 15 years. Yes, I realized, now it is 1935, I have spent 15 years in spreading my guru's teachings in America. Now he recalls me. That afternoon I recounted my experience to a visiting disciple. His spiritual development under Kriya Yoga was so remarkable that I often called him Saint, remembering Babaji's prophecy that America too would produce men and women of divine realization through the ancient yogic path. This disciple and a number of others generously insisted on making a donation for my travels. The financial problem thus solved, I made arrangements to sail, via Europe, for India. Busy weeks of preparations at Mount Washington. In March 1935 I had the Self-Realization Fellowship chartered under the laws of the state of California as a non-profit corporation. To this educational institution go all public donations as well as the revenue from the sale of my books, magazine, written courses, class tuition, and every other source of income. I shall be back, I told my students. Never shall I forget America. 370. Threes Newman, at a farewell banquet given to me in Los Angeles by loving friends, I looked long at their faces and thought gratefully, Lord, he who remembers thee as the soul giver will never lack the sweetness of friendship among mortals. I sailed from New York on June 9, 1935 in the Europa. Two students accompanied me, my secretary, Mr. C. Richard Wright, and an elderly lady from Cincinnati, Miss Etty Bletch. We enjoyed the days of ocean peace, a welcome contrast to the past hurried weeks. Our period of leisure was short-lived, the speed of modern boats has some regrettable features. Like any other group of inquisitive tourists, we walked around the huge and ancient city of London. The following day I was invited to address a large meeting in Caxton Hall, at which I was introduced to the London audience by Sir Francis Younghusband. Our party spent a pleasant day as guests of Sir Harry Lauder at his estate in Scotland. We soon crossed the English Channel to the continent, for I wanted to make a special pilgrimage to Bavaria. This would be my only chance, I felt, to visit the great Catholic mystic, Threes Newman of Connors' youth. Years earlier I had read an amazing account of Threes. Information given in the article was as follows. 1. Threes, born in 1898. Had been injured in an accident at the age of 20, she became blind and paralyzed. 2. She miraculously regained her sight in 1923 through prayers to Saint Teresa, the little flower. Later Threes Newman's limbs were instantaneously healed. 3. From 1923 onward, Threes has abstained completely from food and drink, except for the daily swallowing of one small consecrated wafer. 4. The stigmata, or sacred wounds of Christ, appeared in 1926 on Threes's head, breast, hands, and feet. On Friday of every week thereafter, she has passed through the Passion of Christ, suffering in her own body all his historic agonies. 5. Knowing ordinarily only the simple German of her village, during her Friday trances three utters phrases which scholars have identified as ancient Aramaic. At appropriate times in her vision, she speaks Hebrew or Greek. 6. By ecclesiastical permission, Threes has several times been under close scientific observation. Dr. Fritz Gerlich, editor of a Protestant German newspaper, went to Konnersreuth to expose the Catholic fraud, but ended up by reverently writing her biography. As always, whether in East or West, I was eager to meet a saint. I rejoiced as our little party entered, on July 16, the quaint village of Konnersreuth. The Bavarian peasants exhibited lively interest in our Ford automobile, brought with us from America, and its assorted group: an American young man, an elderly lady, and an olive-hued Oriental with long hair tucked under his coat collar. Threes's little cottage, clean and neat, with geraniums blooming by a primitive well, was alas, silently closed. The neighbors, and even the village postman who passed by, could give us no information. Rain began to fall. My companions suggested that we leave. No, I said stubbornly, I will stay here until I find some clue leading to Threes. 2 hours later we were still sitting in our car amidst the dismal rain. Lord, I sighed complainingly, why didst thou lead me here if she has disappeared? An English-speaking man halted beside us, politely offering his aid. I don't know for certain where Threes is, he said, but she often visits at the home of Professor Wurz, a seminary master of Ichstadt, 80 miles from here. The following morning our party motored to the quiet village of Ichstadt, narrowly lined with cobblestone streets. Dr. Wurz greeted us cordially at his home. Yes, Threes is here. He sent her word of the visitors. A messenger soon appeared with her reply. Though the bishop has asked me to see no one without his permission, I will receive the man of God from India. Deeply touched at these words, I followed Dr. Wurz upstairs to the sitting room. Threes entered immediately, radiating an aura of peace and joy. She wore a black gown and spotless white headdress. Although her age was 37 at this time, she seemed much younger, possessing indeed a childlike freshness and charm. Healthy, well-formed, rosy-cheeked, and cheerful, this is the saint that does not eat. Threes greeted me with a very gentle handshaking. We both beamed in silent communion, each knowing the other to be a lover of God. Dr. Wurz kindly offered to serve as interpreter. As we seated ourselves, I noticed that Threes was glancing at me with naive curiosity. Evidently Hindus had been rare in Bavaria. Don't you eat anything? I wanted to hear the answer from her own lips. No, except a consecrated rice flour wafer, once every morning at 6 o'clock. How large is the wafer? It is paper thin, the size of a small coin. She added, I take it for sacramental reasons. If it is unconsecrated, I am unable to swallow it. Certainly you could not have lived on that, for 12 whole years. I live by God's light. How simple her reply. How Einsteinian. I see you realize that energy flows to your body from the ether, sun, and air. A swift smile broke over her face. I am so happy to know you understand how I live. Your sacred life is a daily demonstration of the truth uttered by Christ. Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God. Again she showed joy at my explanation. It is indeed so. One of the reasons I am here on earth today is to prove that man can live by God's invisible light, and not by food only. Can you teach others how to live without food? She appeared a trifle shocked. I cannot do that, God does not wish it. As my gaze fell on her strong, graceful hands, Threes showed me a little, square, freshly healed wound on each of her palms. On the back of each hand, she pointed out a smaller, crescent-shaped wound, freshly healed. Each wound went straight through the hand. The sight brought to my mind distinct recollection of the large square iron nails with crescent-tipped ends, still used in the Orient, but which I do not recall having seen in the West. The saint told me something of her weekly trances. As a helpless onlooker, I observe the whole Passion of Christ. Each week, from Thursday midnight until Friday afternoon at 1 o'clock, her wounds open and bleed. She loses 10 pounds of her ordinary 121-pound weight. Suffering intensely in her sympathetic love, Threes yet looks forward joyously to these weekly visions of her Lord. I realized at once that her strange life is intended by God to reassure all Christians of the historical authenticity of Jesus' life and crucifixion as recorded in the New Testament, and to dramatically display the ever-living bond between the Galilean master and his devotees. Professor Wurz related some of his experiences with the saint. Several of us, including Threes, often travel for days on sightseeing trips throughout Germany, he told me. It is a striking contrast. While we have 3 meals a day, Threes eats nothing. She remains as fresh as a rose, untouched by the fatigue which the trips cause us. As we grow hungry and hunt for wayside inns, she laughs merrily. The professor added some interesting physiological details. Because Threes takes no food, her stomach has shrunk. She has no excretions, but her perspiration glands function. Her skin is always soft and firm. At the time of parting, I expressed to Threes my desire to be present at her trance. "Yes, please come to Konnersreuth next Friday," she said graciously. "The bishop will give you a permit. I am very happy you sought me out in Ichstadt." Threes shook hands gently, many times, and walked with our party to the gate. Mr. Wright turned on the automobile radio. The saint examined it with little enthusiastic chuckles. Such a large crowd of youngsters gathered that Threes retreated into the house. We saw her at a window, where she peered at us, childlike, waving her hand. From a conversation the next day with two of Threes's brothers, very kind and amiable, we learned that the saint sleeps only 1 or 2 hours at night. In spite of the many wounds in her body, she is active and full of energy. She loves birds, looks after an aquarium of fish, and works often in her garden. Her correspondence is large. Catholic devotees write her for prayers and healing blessings. Many seekers have been cured through her of serious diseases. Her brother Ferdinand, about 23, explained that Threes has the power, through prayer, of working out on her own body the ailments of others. The saint's abstinence from food dates from a time when she prayed that the throat disease of a young man of her parish, then preparing to enter holy orders, be transferred to her own throat. On Thursday afternoon our party drove to the home of the bishop, who looked at my flowing locks with some surprise. He readily wrote out the necessary permit. There was no fee. The rule made by the church is simply to protect Threes from the onrush of casual tourists, who in previous years had flocked on Fridays by the thousands. We arrived Friday morning about 9:30 in Konnersreuth. I noticed that Threes's little cottage possesses a special glass-roofed section to afford her plenty of light. We were glad to see the doors no longer closed, but wide open in hospitable cheer. There was a line of about 20 visitors, armed with their permits. Many had come from great distances to view the mystic trance. Threes had passed my first test at the professor's house by her intuitive knowledge that I wanted to see her for spiritual reasons, and not just to satisfy a passing curiosity. My second test was connected with the fact that, just before I went upstairs to her room, I put myself into a yogic trance state in order to be one with her in telepathic and televisic rapport. I entered her chamber, filled with visitors. She was lying in a white robe on the bed. With Mr. Wright following closely behind me, I halted just inside the threshold, awestruck at a strange and most frightful spectacle. Blood flowed thinly and continuously in an inch-wide stream from Threes's lower eyelids. Her gaze was focused upward on the spiritual eye within the central forehead. The cloth wrapped around her head was drenched in blood from the stigmata wounds of the crown of thorns. The white garment was redly splotched over her heart from the wound in her side at the spot where Christ's body, long ages ago, had suffered the final indignity of the soldier's spear thrust. Threes's hands were extended in a gesture maternal, pleading, Her face wore an expression both tortured and divine. She appeared thinner, changed in many subtle as well as outward ways. Murmuring words in a foreign tongue, she spoke with slightly quivering lips to persons visible before her inner sight. As I was in attunement with her, I began to see the scenes of her vision. She was watching Jesus as he carried the cross amidst the jeering multitude. Suddenly she lifted her head in consternation. The Lord had fallen under the cruel weight. The vision disappeared. In the exhaustion of fervid pity, threes sank heavily against her pillow. At this moment I heard a loud thud behind me. Turning my head for a second, I saw two men carrying out a prostrate body. But because I was coming out of the deep superconscious state, I did not immediately recognize the fallen person. Again I fixed my eyes on Threes's face, deathly pale under the rivulets of blood, but now calm, radiating purity and holiness. I glanced behind me later and saw Mr. Wright standing with his hand against his cheek, from which blood was trickling. "Dick," I inquired anxiously, "were you the one who fell?" "Yes," I fainted at the terrifying spectacle. "Well," I said consolingly, "you are brave to return and look upon the sight again." Remembering the patiently waiting line of pilgrims, Mr. Wright and I silently bade farewell to Threes and left her sacred presence. The following day our little group motored south, thankful that we were not dependent on trains, but could stop the Ford wherever we chose throughout the countryside. We enjoyed every minute of a tour through Germany, Holland, France, and the Swiss Alps. In Italy we made a special trip to Assisi to honor the Apostle of Humility, Saint Francis. The European tour ended in Greece, where we viewed the Athenian temples, and saw the prison in which the gentle Socrates had drunk his death potion. One is filled with admiration for the artistry with which the Greeks have everywhere wrought their very fancies in alabaster. We took ship over the sunny Mediterranean, disembarking at Palestine. Wandering day after day over the Holy Land, I was more than ever convinced of the value of pilgrimage. The Spirit of Christ is all-pervasive in Palestine. I walked reverently by his side at Bethlehem, Gethsemane, Calvary, the Holy Mount of Olives, and by the River Jordan and the Sea of Galilee. Our little party visited the birth manger, Joseph's carpenter shop, the tomb of Lazarus, the house of Martha and Mary, the hall of the Last Supper. Antiquity unfolded, scene by scene, I saw the divine drama that Christ once played for the ages. On to Egypt, with its modern Cairo and ancient pyramids. Then the boat down the narrow Red Sea, over the vast Arabian Sea, lo, India. Chapter 40. I return to India. Gratefully I was inhaling the blessed air of India. Our boat Rajputana docked on August 22, 1935 in the huge harbour of Bombay. Even this, my first day off the ship, was a foretaste of the year ahead. 12 months of ceaseless activity. Friends had gathered at the dock with garlands and greetings. Soon, at our suite in the Taj Mahal Hotel, there was a stream of reporters and photographers. Bombay was a city new to me. I found it energetically modern, with many innovations from the West. Palms line the spacious boulevards, magnificent state structures vie for interest with ancient temples. Very little time was given to sightseeing, however, I was impatient, eager to see my beloved guru and other dear ones. Consigning the Ford to a baggage car, our party was soon speeding eastward by train toward Calcutta. Our arrival at Howrah station found such an immense crowd assembled to greet us that for a while we were unable to dismount from the train. The young Maharaja of Kasimbazar and my brother Baishna headed the reception committee. I was unprepared for the warmth and magnitude of our welcome. Preceded by a line of automobiles and motorcycles, and amidst the joyous sound of drums and conch shells, Miss Bletch, Mr. Wright, and myself, flower garlanded from head to foot, drove slowly to my father's home. My aged parent embraced me as one returning from the dead. Long we gazed on each other, speechless with joy. Brothers and sisters, uncles, aunts, and cousins, students and friends of years long past were grouped around me, not a dry eye among us. Passed now into the archives of memory, The scene of loving reunion vividly endures, unforgettable in my heart.